I'm going to talk about what constitutes useful, let's say, systems work, experimental work. So, I think there's a really big gap between the systems folks see as a
actually, we should probably interject in that for a second. I also realize it's a very ECS way of thinking about things, which is in CS, systems is the opposite of theory, whereas in EE, theoretical work happens in systems. So there's a language issue here.
I'm not from CS background, so experimental work and theory work. So the systems work, so they are experimental work and looking at a more of practical working solutions. Glamorous really put, people say the systems approach. I've been working on this area for 20 years, and so I've seen all kinds of theoretical work, but they're all garbage, and I have this systems approach. This one works, it solves everything. And that's what the systems guy usually say, and then the theory guy say disparagingly, that's really at all. This is simply an engineering tweak and hack. I've been hearing that all the time. That's one of the reasons my paper is getting kicked rejected. And a lot of things are, the metrics are sometimes not well defined, and then it's not quite clear what they're really optimizing for. And also, when they actually have the systems approach, what they try to solve, and we try to solve, is some really specific scenarios or specific set of cases. But there's nothing about the sort of general, comprehensive, bad quote cases and things like that. So on the other hand, theory, it actually works for all the cases within sort of defined scope. And defined scope, fortunately, with a lot of, impractical assumptions, like assumptions we have seen today, is like, disk model, and everything is within a single hub, we can sense each other, and all kinds of, and may not be used in reality, and this in the current platform. And the good thing about this is actually defined in terms of really a way to define the metrics, and within that metrics is always optimal. And this really nice thing to say about it. But it's sort of this tool actually going side by side. They don't actually systems people don't speak theory language. And so they don't actually understand what theoreticians say. I shouldn't really generally say that. And theory people are saying, and all this experimental works are just the hacks. And so this one actually continues and never closes. And so I'm going to look at one specific example is congestion control. And this is something I've been working on 20 years. Okay, so you see, in the wireless networks, so a lot of people try to fix this congestion control problem, and one way to fix it is just simply having some kind of add-on or hacks to TCP. And there's many solutions. You see EFNN, ATP, ADTCP, ADTFRC, LED, NRD, COPAS, and I can. There's so many of those things. And the thing is that none of these things actually works well in the general network. They actually solve specific problems, but if you put it on the general, like not necessarily just single, not necessarily just sensor network or mesh network. If you're looking at a more general type of P2P kind of communications or a lot of communications at the same time, multiple connections, then all these things are really failing. And also, there are other solutions that not based on TCP that recently came up. Like fusion is one, rate limiting, there's COPAS and other solutions. They are also specific for the particular environment, like where you have gateways or all the traffic's going from many to one and things like that. So this actually works fairly well in their set scenario and environment. But the thing is that this sort of, there are a lot of knobs that you have to control when it comes to the congestion control. And they're tweaking here and there, and all of a sudden, based on some intuition, wow, we got some solution. And that's how systems approach actually go about it. And on the other end, the theory, actually, there's a lot of huge amount of theoretical work on congestion control, especially on the cross-layer optimization, and looking at the optimizing the scheduling, routing, and flow control, rate control, and I think it's Hasselbus's work is really amazing, and there's a lot of follow-up on that. But so there's a couple of problems. It's the same problems that we see. It's like that I talked about. It's like the assumptions about the scheduling MAC layer. You have to come up, to solve this maximum matching problem. You need to generate the fairness model. That's like anti-Hart problem, and also requires a packet to be transmitted to any random direction. So if there's a network lightly loaded, you have to send packet almost to anywhere in order to get seeded congestion. So for instance, to solve the congestion problem, they are creating congestion in the network in some sense. And it works for specific utility metrics like optimizing throughput, not for delay, for instance. And so those things are sort of preventing the systems folks to implement theoretical solutions. But somehow, amazingly, systems experimental people haven't really looked into this type of theoretical work. But I think what constitutes good experimental work is actually start from the experiment, the theoretical work, and showing this all the optimal results and things like that, and borrow intuitions from that, and implement it, and approximate some of the sort of very the computational intensive one or the unrealistic assumption approximated with the view of the system experimental platforms which you currently have. And so that's what I think is there's many other things that's, that constitute good experimental work, but I'm just pointing out one thing. I think Bhaskar and other people were pointing out the other things. And so I'm going to so the thing is that by doing this, what we gain is that the improved performance, but without much loss of the generality. Because generality actually coming from the theoretical aspects, they actually look at many, many different cases that actually have proven it is working. And borrowing the same intuition and then and optimizing the approximating the sort of the heavy computational part or unrealistic part with realistic systems parameter for the same intuition of optimization, the same and the principle applied for theoretical work, we can actually get much better experimental systems out of it. And so that as a sort of example, what we have done is that we took one of the Hasselbus's or there's a lot of variants of it, and they convert that to implement it in the real system. Okay, so John mentioned about the CB Monet this project. What we have done is we actually took the CB Monet and implemented in the Adafruit platform using the same controlled theoretical approach. Okay? So there must be some approximation we have to do in terms of the scheduling and also the routing aspect. So this is the test bed we have in it. Here in our building, we have about 70 nodes here. Here we're only showing 50 nodes of Socrates, and each one has two interfaces in there. And Mac is Atheros 802.11 chips. And so, demo. So here's what we're seeing. We're running about 60 flows concurrently at the same time between the random source and destination. Okay. And we're running TCP, and also we're running ECM, and also running the solution, control theoretic solution on top of it. And what we're showing here is that this is actually per flow average throughput. So we measure throughput of each flow. And then we got the 60 samples of it, and then we just plotted the CD echo. So this means actually for the TCP Reno, we're actually saying TCP Reno. In fact, we're using TCP SAT in this case. get the selective act. So this is on low scale. What we're seeing is that the lateral flow is actually getting less than 100 kilobits per second. It's actually almost zero with TCP. So we're seeing about more than 50% of flows actually start, not getting any throughput out of it. Okay. So this actually corresponds to your comments that 3 hop equal to zero case with TCP. So on the here, what we are showing is that the green bar is the packet losses caused by the channel errors, okay, the collisions or hidden terminal things. And the red bar is caused by the actual buffer overflow, it's a congestion. So a lot of nodes actually getting congested in this case, with the TCP. And this is actually showing, if you may not familiar with the ETX is an expected transmission number, meaning that it's basically packet losses. Okay? So if you have a larger number, it's actually number of transmissions you have to do to send one packet across. So it means 50 packets, you have to send 50 tries to send one packet successfully. And so if the larger the number, you actually have a higher packet loss. Okay? And we're showing that with the throughput. So we're seeing that although you have a very small loss rate, you still get almost zero throughput for a lot of flow. Okay. And so we fast forward this. So now we actually put the ECN inside the routers, okay, and make TCP tolerating to the packet losses. So the TCP will not react to the packet losses. Okay, it only reacts to the ECN or explicit congestion notification coming from the network. And so if you do that, we still have a lot of same issues. We see a lot of congestion going on. And then what we're seeing is that the some flows getting some throughput, but we count all these flows below 1 kilobits per second, they are actually being starved. Okay. So even though we actually use ECN, we see a lot of flows getting starved. And some of these flows actually getting some throughput compared to TCP. That's because of that. We turned off the its sensitivity to packet loss and doesn't react to the packet loss. The congestion window does not react to that. So it's not really issues with the packet losses within the network. Okay, so fast forward this. Now they're running the solution, control theoretic solution. So it's actually the whole implementation is done inside the kernel. It's just below the transport TCP layer and on top of the IP layer. Okay. And so the blue line is to the control theoretic approach. You can actually see that this is actually going to really go almost vertical.
Can you repeat what you did said you're implementing? So it's on top of the transport layer that you're doing?
Below
the transport
below
layer.
But above the MAC and the router layer?
On top of IP.
Okay, top of IP. What you're implementing?
It's basically Q-back pressure.
Yeah, so basically the Tasciola's reserve, differential backlog scheme. Actually, I'm going to explain that in a little more detail, but it's actually looking at the difference of Q with the neighbor, and based on the difference of size, you set your MAC priority. So the MAC priority is based on the backhaul parameter. Mm-hmm. So using 802.11e, we just set the window, potential windows, according to the Q sizes, and we see a lot of flow that you're getting much more throughput than this guy. Another good thing is that we don't see any congestion here. We don't see any buffer overflow. It's really nice scheme, good theoretical work. But what we have to do is we have to implement the MAC scheme, the scheduling, using the 802.11e, the prioritization scheme. And also, we took out the routing section, we made just a fixed routing. And there's no because of fixed routing, we don't have the ETX probings and control packets going on. And entire implementation is based on the simple overhearing. So
simple
overhearing.
How many, what's the maximum coupling?
Maximum what?
Coupling.
Copper.
Hop-length.
Hop-length. We get maximum about 7 to 8 hops.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
And you get what throughput in the 6 to 7 hops?
6 to 7 hops is some, oh.
I hope you don't get 1/6.
Yeah, well, as we get the almost 100 kilobits per second.
And what's the maximum?
Maximum on that.
What is the available link capacity?
On this 6 hops?
No.
Or the entire?
Per link.
Or this is over 11 megabps. The 11 megabps is
11 megabps, and you get 100 kilobits per second.
Over 6 hops, 7 hops, 6 to 7 hops. Well, no, but with the 60 flows competing at the same time.
Uh-huh.
Okay, they are all sharing. If you actually just one flow,
so
you can actually get about a half megabps out of it. So.
I'm just doing the stupid pipe calculation, right?
Right.
11 megabits per second divided by 60, how much is it?
Well, it's not just the 6, because you have to scale
60,
it.
60.
Yeah.
It's 150, right? Or 170.
Yeah. Well, but you're actually competing with, but if you have only just have a single flow, that's what you're going to get. If I'm the only flow running over 6 hops.
If I'm a stupid wild guy, right?
Right.
And I try to compute capacity dimension in thinking pipes, right? Pipe flows. I will take the capacity divided by the flows, and if I do sort of, you know, equal sharing, I divide the total capacity by 60 and get what everybody should get. Yes.
Yeah, but there's
so interference.
You're going to get very, very
right.
Not only 60.
No, the point is, you know, okay.
Let
me ask the question, okay?
Sure.
The title of the session is what's a useful experimental result. So what I want to know is what's your maximum bit rate that you can give me through over a small period of time, not my average.
Over the 6 hops?
Yeah.
Yeah, you can get about half a meg or 400 kilobits per second.
So one clarification about what you mean by idea. So you're using back pressure to assign priorities at its link separately. So you assign MAC priorities based on the difference between the next call queue and your queue. So essentially you're not solving any, which is perfectly fine with me, you're not solving any centralized optimal schedule.
No,
you're prioritizing locally, so essentially, I mean, in my terminology, you're controlling the rate of its link based on the difference in the back.
So just by taking the intuition of differential backhaul only, and then replacing that with very simple MAC scheme, you can still do much better than
so have you tried to even just look at your queue as Zhang suggested? Perhaps if you just look at your own queue and you do exactly the same thing.
No, if you just look at your own queue, if you just look at your own queue, you have the other corner cases.
You need the other corner, right?
So,
is a single commodity? Single destination?
Single destination, no. It's actually the random source and destination 60 flows.
So are you using a sync like FIFO or are you using per flow?
We're using per destination queue.
Okay.
So here's we're showing an experiment that's running a video experiment. So we can actually do video with the dynamic traffic at the same time with this solution. So it was just a video server running outside, and then there's a receiver here, a real-time flow, and then we also run the other background TCP flow dynamically in the network. So this is with just a simple UDP the streaming and the TCP running at the same time. So, but at this time, we're not running TCP, we're just running single flow of video. It runs pretty well when you don't have any interference. So now we're going to start running the TCP at the same time. Okay, we're going to stop now. Okay. So that's with the TCP running on the side. So we see a lot of frames actually getting lost. So it's actually going beyond 200 frames
same point. Okay? And then at the same time, what we're seeing? Video getting.
The UDP goes through, right?
Excuse me?
The UDP goes through.
Yeah, UDP, and then the TCP is a background traffic.
But the UDP goes through when you have a problem with TCP, yes?
UDP is actually, even UDP flows actually get affected. In fact, these flows, this packet is actually getting dropped because of TCP flow running at the same time. So you see that the, well, we just finished. So even the, this is actually showing the distribution of the TCP. And now we're going to show the control duality approach. So now first running the UDP traffic. And all of this actually, you know, done, the scheduling is done with the differential backlog. And so we're running TCP. This is with the control theoretic TCP. So by the way, all our, since we implemented below transport, our implementation supports regular TCP, the socket interfaces. So with TCP running, it actually goes pretty well. I mean, only six.
What are we seeing here?
So we're seeing the video traffic is going pretty
well.
What's
the stack?
What?
What's the stack?
What's the what?
What's the protocol stack?
Protocol stack, this is UDP stack and this is TCP stack. And they're running at the same time. So they're actually showing.
I guess the before and
the
after.
Right, so the same UDP and TCP, and underneath we put the our control theoretic approach, back pressure scheme.
Okay.
So it's a supporting same socket interfaces and everything, but the underneath it's different.
And the back pressure only controls the access.
Not the access, inside all the network, every router is actually doing
the backup.
Right.
Can you do routing also? Or
medium access, what you mean?
Right.
Yeah.
Medium access.
Right. We control the medium access based on the back pressure.
Fixed routing again.
Right. Fixed the routing.
All
right. And then also, you know, does the actual scheduling inside based on. So whichever has a longer differential backlog, we get higher priority in the transmission within its node, also among the competing node using the priority schemes. So what I'd like to really point out is you know, it's not that our system works really well. It's because it's a good example in the sense we take a result from theoretical work and by, you know, borrowing the intuition and then applying the heuristics, we can still get pretty much better performance than just simply tweaking the knobs and here and there in the system's approach. So that's my.
Want to go to the questions?
So one question I have, when you implemented the CD Mané MAC
right.
on this differential backlog, right? Did you implement it within the 8.11 restraints?
We modified the driver.
Okay.
So that the 802.11e supports only, you know, small number of queues. So we actually made it to 8 different queues.
Okay.
And a different queue for different parity levels, so that we have more diverse, or more, you know.
So you get 8 possible priority levels.
Then 3 or 2.
Okay. Then you did the access decisions packet by packet, or?
Yeah, per packet.
Per packet?
Yeah.
So what is the question? You say it's overleaving, so each packet contains the queue length.
Right, so each packet contains the queue length of each destination queue.
For the destination.
Right, so because
for the destination.
Right, so the packet actually destined to node X.
Right.
And so each node contains one destination queue for one destination. For instance,
you get by pressure by listening to the other node.
Yes. Right, the packet. So we get the finer granularity in controlling the priority. So the actual trick is a mapping between the differential queue sizes,
yeah.
Okay, into MAC.
What about using based on the packet themselves?
So that's one of the things we actually I didn't explain it in more detail about when we implement the media traffic. So we use the actual delay for priority mapping.
along with the TCPs using, you know, differential backlog. So by having, you know, combining these two, actually works fairly well. And so the original theory doesn't really say anything about so delay sensitive applications. It's all about the optimizing throughput, and that's what we care about. So what we did was we implemented this the EDF scheduling on top of it, and that makes things work very nicely.
So you actually use not pure back pressure, but back pressure plus response time feedback, right?
Right. So for the throughput optimizing flows, like TCP, best effort, we use the differential backlog scheme.
Only?
Yeah, only. And then for the media real-time flows, and we use the EDF schedule.
And we'll drop packets, then
that's right.
Okay, let's move on to Oscar.
So I think Indra had this wonderful diagram of the train tracks and being on opposite sides of the tracks. I think the most dangerous place to be is in the middle where the train is going to come and I've been trying to explore this dangerous territory for a few years. I think it's a perfect analogy. So with respect to this panel, I think there's two things that really appeal to me in that zone in the middle. One is exactly what Indra was talking about, which is this whole exercise of trying to translate the theoretical algorithms to a practical implementation. Because the process of this conversion is, in my experience, not a trivial one, and maybe I can just share brief thoughts on that. And I think the other kind of useful experimental result, which I feel we don't have enough of in our community, is to go beyond the current practice. In particular, so much of our experimental work seems to be tied to existing commercial off-the-shelf hardware that I think the interesting questions are right in pushing beyond, if we had completely different capabilities in terms of the hardware, how should we re-envision the networking stack? And I think these questions have bubbled up a lot in the past couple of years with cooperative communication. I think that's really the other kind of useful experimental result in our area. And I'll kind of give my thoughts on that. So in this first part, I think there's this huge open area, and I think I can literally count on one hand the number of papers where people have actually gone and tried to implement cross-layer optimization, back pressure algorithms on a real testbed, found out what the challenges are, what is that gap between the pen and paper analysis and the real implementation. I think Injun's work is one of those few that I can think of. And it's rarely a trivial task, because when you're trying to do this, the theory, and you're trying to do the analysis, you have to adopt certain simplifying abstractions to make your theory tractable, to get the proofs to work out, for your protocols to converge. And all of these things break in the real world. There are going to be packet losses. There are going to be asynchrony. There's going to be random delays between when you get the information from the neighbors. And so the question is, in creating a protocol, it's not a trivial exercise of just, you know, writing in C what somebody wrote in MATLAB. It's actually a lot more than that. And I can, I guess, share a recent experience doing this with a very simple example that a student of mine, Avinash, has been working on, which is for wireless sensor networks. You're given a fixed routing tree, and you're trying to make sure that the source rates allocated to all the sources is maximum fair. And under a particular capacity model, which I don't want to dwell on much, which is called the receiver capacity model. But the basic theoretical algorithm that you can, you know, prove nice results about is very simple. All you really do is allocate rates based on the remaining bandwidth, and then you set these rates accordingly at every level of the tree. And you can prove formally that this will converge in a finite time. What you converge to is a maximum fair solution. The problem is, though, that this is a pen and paper exercise with a lot of idealized assumptions. You have to assume that everything is synchronous, you have global coordination, your flows are static, the links are perfect. But in the real world, you have to sort of rip off all of these assumptions. And I think John Burris this morning raised this point repeatedly, which is that there's often this information lag between what you're hearing from your neighbors and when it was actually, the state that you're getting is typically stale by the time you're getting that. And these distributed, and they have to be implemented in a distributed way with dynamic flows and so on. And this is still ongoing work. But by the time you translate those three lines of the theoretical algorithm to something that works in practice, it looks like this hideous mess. And it's got all kinds of hacks in it. There's sort of these alpha parameters that get switched to different values here and there. And it's a complete hack job, which is it starts with the inspiration of the original protocol, but then you try to put this protocol in the real world, and it just breaks spectacularly. Like, nothing converges. Your information is showing up, two rounds too late for it to be meaningful. And I'm not saying that this is the right solution, but all I'm saying with this figure is that in your first cut attempt to translate something that works beautifully on paper to something that works well on a test bed, this is what the outcome ends up looking like. And it is possible you can then go back and take from this, back to the drawing board, and this is something that we're working on. Can you think about it, cleanly a priori and somehow redesign it to be robust to these communication failures, to the asynchrony, and the other issues? And at the end of it, this algorithm that we have, the proof that we have for convergence no longer holds, in fact. The very basic lemmas that the proof is based on are completely violated. They're based on monotonicity of the rate increments, whereas here you have to go up, down, and sideways sometimes to get to where you want to. But at the end of the day, the solution that you get in practice, if we compare with state-of-the-art, what we might call more ad hoc approaches, which are tweaks of existing AIND schemes, you do see performance improvements by going through this process, which is you see improvements in convergence time, in the delays that you encounter in the end-to-end flows, and so on. So I think this is a useful experimental result in the sense that you can then go back to the theoretical table and say the interesting theoretical questions are in fact exactly the ones of how should you estimate these random dynamic pieces of information? How do you prove convergence in the real world rather than under perfect synchronized iterative models? Because the algorithms that come out of that simply don't work. And what it takes to make it work changes all your theoretical assumptions. I guess in the second direction, what I feel is really missing in our field is that we have just amazing work in the physical layer communications area. And then we have networking researchers who are unable to really keep up with the developments in the physical layer communications. And I think the reason they're unable to keep up is that there's nothing in the middle, the simplified abstraction that they could look at and point to and say, okay, this is what I will use and build on to do the higher layer design. And I think those abstractions have to come from real, tangible systems. You want to be able to work with something like 802.11, right? So if we talk about cooperative communications, as I guess we will in one of the sessions tomorrow, it would be great if, as networking layer researchers, we had access to hardware that kind of implemented some versions of this. So in fact, as an example of why this would be useful, you can show on sort of theoretical grounds that under an idealized environment where you have nodes that are cooperating perfectly, they have perfect channel information, you have coherent combining, that if you're just trying to get one piece of information everywhere in the network, so essentially the process is as follows. You send out a packet, a bunch of nodes hear it, all of them sort of combine in an ideal world to push this out to the next set of nodes and so on. You can just imagine very easily that this is going to grow. Like, the set of users that are going to be able to hear this packet is going to, the radius is going to grow at every step. In fact, you can show that the time to propagate this information in a cooperative network to complete a flood is not proportional to the diameter of the network, but actually logarithm of the diameter of the network. So you have this ultra-fast flooding, which in theory you could achieve if cooperation could be ideally implemented. Now, we know it can't be done in this ideal manner. So the real open question is, can we show experimentally, given all of the limitations in the real world of not being able to get perfect channel information, maybe not coherent combining, what is the practical equivalent of this? Maybe you don't get logarithmic improvements, but maybe they're still substantial enough to justify right that direction. But I feel like what we're really missing in the community are people that can help us bridge that gap.
I think the challenge there, though, is that we don't have software-defined radio, right? I too would love to have an actual radio that can implement all of those.
Right. It could either be software-defined radio or hardware builders that are willing to build something that's not off the shelf today. Well, I mean, who are the people, the hardware people that could do this?
But I think you need the flexibility, because the point of these new methods many parameters to tune and optimize, and you need to be able to set that appropriately to achieve potentially higher layer goals. And we don't have that. This is one of my huge frustrations with a lot of the sensor. sensor network research that's out there that's so dependent on what a Bird remote can provide you with respect to a physical layer.
Mm-hmm.
So there are very interesting, complicated methodologies that are being developed on a physical layer that you would never deploy.
Right. I mean, I guess as a simple example, these modes, the 15.4 devices, the communication technology there dates back to maybe the 70s or 80s at best.
Right.
We're talking about, you know, a 20-year lag in what is known in the physical layer communications community and the hardware that we're working for higher layer design in that space. And there's really no reason it should be such a
way. I would be actually, experimented on a platform like that. I had to completely hack. I didn't, my student did, completely hack the Mac because I did want collisions. To me, they didn't mean collisions. And I had to completely hack the platform. And I could have done much better if
you could also, for instance, change
the software allowed me to have more control.
So I remember in August, I was asking some guys at Sitcom, and they were telling me that software radios are available for $5,000 from Texas Instruments. But then 2 or 3 months ago, I heard that you can get software radios for $500.
And
you give $200 to get the simple box related to the level. So
the new radios exist. I mean, there are test beds that are made with new radios. There is a basic problem with that. The GNU radio is essentially transmitting this RF waveform, and you communicate to that radio through a USB port. So that's asynchronous. You don't control the time. You don't have control of what the radio is doing at a certain time. And that kills you, because essentially you are limited by that bottleneck. So you cannot really try. You're never going to win over other protocols that instead don't have that limitation. So.
Yeah, we've been working with the USRP quite a bit, so we're actually using it for Mac layer research. So I have to admit, it's really great. You do have to put in a lot of effort, though. This is not something where we just decide we're going to buy it, and tomorrow we're doing research in software radios. Also, since we're talking about experimental results here, if you submit papers, you need to be very careful, because people are going to criticize you a lot for using platform that is kind of not Wi-Fi, not in the same space as Wi-Fi. So you can be very, it's kind of a tricky territory to be in, but it does have a huge amount of flexibility. It's actually really great.
What is the problem now you run into with GNU radios?
Because you are limited by the bottleneck is your USB port. You have to send that waveform. You don't control. It's an asynchronous problem sending that. So the computer has no control on when exactly the transmission is going to happen.
It's a timing issue. One is just the bandwidth to get between the computer and the device is not very much because of just the interface through which it connects to the computer. But the bigger problem people do in Mac research is their turnaround time. So the signal comes back to the processor, which is now slow. For instance, you cannot generate 10 microsecond acts that you can generate in .11.
If you take a very fast board and you take the software from the GNU and you re-implement it on Linux, then you get around all the problems.
No, you don't. With the USRP, unless you're willing to program the FPGA,
the FPGA is the only option.
You will not get anywhere. You really need to be willing to program the FPGA.
Yeah, and that's fine.
So I guess this might not be necessarily exactly related to what you talked about, but it will touch upon the danger zone that you were talking about, which is the middle ground. I feel like as a community, neither of the two sides appreciate being in the middle. So we have had faculty candidates whose work neither impressed the theorists nor the experimentalists, because they understand somewhat what we do, but they're not necessarily information theorists. And then at the same time, they don't impress the sort of RF guys and how they're interested in sort of the latest in the sort of devices. So there seems to be a lack of genuine appreciation for the kind.
In fact, I was going to say it's an issue of respect too, from sort of either side of the
right.
If you're not doing deep theory, or you're not doing the same experimental work.
I have been in meetings where a candidate is labeled as, oh, they're not very deep. I mean, what are they doing? They're just repeat retransmission. They're just doing a little bit of repetition coding, right?
Right.
And so the sort of difficulty gets lost because we are very, very much disciplined
I get the Xilinx stuff, for FPGA running code, okay? Which can automatically give me code that runs on FPGA, right? Now I translate the entire program into software. Right? So why do I not do that?
I mean, you can do that, that's the painful route, but generally it's not.
If you take that and you write formal models of the protocols, and you write them, of course I'm requiring a lot of knowledge here. Okay?
Yes.
But what I'm talking about is why JTRS failed, okay? Because it didn't have that knowledge. So if I go from, let me put really very blunt, I go from UML models down to automatic code generation, generate the whole stack, formal model, test it, go immediately and link to the Xilinx stuff, and do automatic code generation around Xilinx, that will get people like, I don't want to say like us, but people like us that are interested in that, go immediately from algorithm to implementation, yes?
If you're willing to go down that path.
So there is an easy answer. Right. Okay, why don't we ask some of the agencies, right, to take a group that is competent in this area, create something everybody can share, and then give it for free, like Boeing did about 6 years ago with their wonderful experiment where they gave their distributed software free to academics.
So it has been asked. NSF has been asked kind of to provide some.
Yeah, but who did it? Because
nobody
has
done it yet.
This cannot be decided by panels, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Just to be decided by people know what they're talking about.
I'm just saying that that has been discussed.
Sure.
even part of wireless, Jimmy, some people are planning on doing this. So the wireless part of Jimmy.
And you know, were you there in the Jimmy discussion and the fine discussion of what we use for both of us the week before Easter? Okay, well, take the report and leave.
So, I guess in conclusion, I just wanted to say that I feel there aren't enough people on the track. And maybe we need to slow down the trains or something to enable that to happen.
Right. No, but Pascal, there is a real problem here, okay? From the point of view of education, okay? Every time I try to educate people like that, right, there are not enough courses in our university between computer science and engineering to do that. There are a few exceptions. I think Berkeley can do it in terms of more than one student at a time, and maybe CMU, and maybe UPenn. But there isn't, right, in the regular curriculum of either ECE or CS, a set of courses that the master's students say can go through and know what I just described and be able to do it. I don't even find this in some of the best people in industry labs, and then they come back and say, well, you know, we tried to do all the software engineering and system engineering, and it failed. Of course it failed, because we really did not have the appropriate knowledge to do this the right way. But I have a question for you regarding your proofs, right? Suppose we take this theoretical algorithm, right, and we go to your hacks. Hacks means the actual implementation, right? So have you tried the following? Suppose I write a formal model for this, right? And then I go through a combination of model checking and theorem proving and try to reprove it. Why I'm saying this? There were two examples.
What would you prove it under? I guess you need some model of the real world delay bounds.
Whatever your condition is that you're trying to prove, you can translate, I hope, to an if then statement.
Sure.
Right? Then I can put to an automatic theorem proven and ask if it is correct or not. There is precedence of success in this area, right? Mm-hmm. There's the effort that...
I hadn't thought of that direction at all.
There's the precedence that proved that the hacking model of the AODB had all the desired properties, which we could prove analytically.
Mm-hmm.
And we did the same thing for Tora.
That completely didn't cross my mind.
And it's not so far-fetched, because there's a whole group of people at NRL, okay, and other places, two or three in the country, they do this routinely. And of course, the problem is, with some of this routing algorithms in particular, you have so many done infinities at you that your sort of model checker or theorem prover blows up because of infinity problem. So I'm not saying it was going to work, but it's worthwhile.
Worthwhile to look into something.
The payoff, if you do, is in addition to your theory, you will be able to put everything into an automatic code generation and create code that actually runs on the nodes.
Right.
Now, that we have done for routing protocols to some extent, that you can actually write it for the formal model of the routing protocol, start it from UML, go to Rhapsody, automatically generate the code, put it on the node, and it works correctly. But I would like to see more of that.
It's not a methodology, I think that's
bridging the system guys with whatever you call them, with the theory guys.
Yeah.
That's the ultimate, but it's not easy, right?
Yeah, but being in the middle is not easy. it's a danger zone as well.
It's never easy, you know.
But it's not. It's a, as she pointed out, it's
either side appreciate this middle guy. Exactly. If you go to systems conference, you say you're not a system person.
You're not a theoretician. When you start your career, right, you're warned by your chairman and by your dean that you're not to be caught in the so-called no man's land, right?
Green field.
I have a question actually to start some controversy here. For example, if you look at essentially the idea is, again, I don't know what constitutes theory exactly, but the idea is that if there are two nodes that are in the vicinity of each other that can sense each other, then they should not be transmitting it. But if you look at measurements today, that's not necessarily true in all cases. I mean, there are two nodes that could sense each other, could still transmit. So in some sense, this model that we are talking about, the UDG model that people have been using, did it actually lead us to the wrong design? I mean, if you basically try to kind of go through or follow what theory is saying based on some of the wrong assumptions that they are making, can our practical design end up being flawed? So this is, I think, something, I mean, yes, theory is good, but at the same time, we need to, when, you know, it's unclear to me that, in fact, that is the right approach.
No, and I think that's a reasonable question, too. In fact, that was something I didn't really want to delve into at the time that we had, but we've also done some work where we look at just completely discarding those assumptions, looking at just the capture effect with power control and sort of, you know, re-envisioning the medium axis from scratch, and you can get better performance if you completely discard a certain view of what the world should look like. And you design your protocols around that worldview, it can be quite different from if you just start with a clear and just look at, from the ground up, from the observations, what makes more sense. But you're right.
There's a basic cultural problem. I will not say anything bad about Berkeley, because they feed me. But the education is split. So the CS students do not take any course on the physical layer or any mathematical course for that matter. Right? And,
they take discrete mathematics.
Discrete mathematics. So they talk about probability, but discrete probability, so with mass function, not density. And we are trying to change that. And the reverse is true also. EE theoreticians, right, do not know much about computer architecture, about software architecture. They play rarely in the lab of the times. So I think there's a cultural issue that it's for us to solve.
Huge problem.
It's very difficult, but we have to solve it. So in Berkeley, an anecdote, right, we have an introductory networking course that I pushed for the last 25 years to be unique for the EE and CS students. And in fact, it's been taught on alternate semesters by the CS and the EE faculty, and there are two versions of the course. Same down version, I think, but there are two different versions. And I don't know how we can unify them.
I guess I am victim of some false advertisement. Never mind.
Yes.
Okay, let's move on to Ratul to hear Microsoft's perspective.
Sorry, it's not Microsoft's perspective. Just to be clear, I speak for myself here. Anyway, on all this twist between experimental and theoretical research, I was just talking to my colleague Jitu, and he handed this beautiful quote. Which basically sums up my position on experimental versus theoretical research, and which is basically the difference between doing and thinking. So it's basically this, from this Marathi poet, it's the hand that shapes the head and not the other way around. And that should give you an idea which camp I fall in. Going forward, so the panel of the blurb had this premise in it that it's either the hardware or market realities that limit the value of an experimental result. And why I submit to that premise that yes, the hardware constrains us in certain ways, the market realities do constrain us in certain ways, but very often I see for good experimental work, that is usually not a strong enough reason for people to be paralyzed. I think people are smart enough that they come up with approximations of the experiments they want to do, which in case, like if the experiments are successful, it basically becomes a bootstrapping point for new hardware to be developed, in sense. And examples that come to mind from recent past is like, you know, people wanted to experiment with new Macs, and the new Mac hardware wasn't there. They started building Macs by just leveraging the pure broadcast capability. So everything that you didn't want in the Mac, back off, act, would get turned off, and just based on the raw capability that hardware provided, you started building new Macs and experimenting with it. And these days, of course, you have software radios, and people are expanding very bold new ideas that were not possible before. Yes, the software radios have limitations, but very often you can prove your ideas that you want to prove with these radios. You may not have the right turnaround time and whatnot. So in my view, like, hardware or market realities, they've not been a very, very, they're not, I mean, they are limiting, but they're not strongly limiting. Instead, what bugs me about experimental work, and this is not in contrast to theoretical work at all, this is just in an absolute sense what bugs me most about experimental work today, is when I see a paper or see some experimental work, I have very little idea, does this experimental result hold up in a slightly different setting? And this different setting could just be, take the test bed to the building next door, and you will have no idea what works, what does not. And you could ask the same question for theoretical results, and again, putting on an experimental thing, you say the answer is always no. But in experimental results, you're in a worse position because you don't know if the answer is no or yes. So that, in my mind, is like the biggest thing. But let's recognize, this is a problem that is common to most real work. Like network measurement, which I used to do a lot before, has the same problem. You do some measurements on the internet or anywhere. Do they apply broadly? Who knows? Even cancer research, based on some kind of tumors or cells, has had that problem. Are the medications we are developing, are they general enough or not? So once you recognize that this is not a problem that is unique to like wireless experimental work, maybe there are some solutions. And maybe if we have time, we can bounce off that. One thing in thinking about like how, so basically what I'm trying to say, like the goal of good experimental work should be to actually be able to specify for others to be able to generalize whether or not this result applies to some other setting. And by setting could be just different topology, workload, different MACs and whatnot. In thinking about like how can you actually understand the generality of your work, one thing that falls out immediately is that the context of your exact experiments or your experimental setup has to be captured at all the layers, because all the layers are important in what result actually comes out in there. And I'm just going to have some examples in this slide and the next. And just to be sure, I don't mean to bash on anybody's work here. My work has similar limitations. This is just to get us brainstorming that all of these things actually do matter. So take the file layer, for example. The file layer that you the exact file layer that you use or the modulation you use has a big impact. And examples of work that kind of experimental works that fall, you know, all these new techniques on analog network coding, successive interference cancellation, or zigzag decoding that are coming out, they claim that, you know, they'll work for higher modulations, but their experiments are limited to BPSK due to whatever limitations. At this point, me as a reader, I'm wondering, does it actually work or not? And that's an example of, like, you know, them not being clearly stating that, you know, you don't know, versus similarly for routing, you know, what kinds of losses occur in your network? Are there mostly, you know, loss rates between links? Is it just 0 or 1? You living in a binary world, or are you living in a gray world, varying anywhere between 0 to 1? And it has a huge impact on routing. You know, ETX works great in a gray loss pattern regime, but ETX not necessary if your loss is a binary. And you know, RoofNet people did some great bit of work in their particular environment, AW11B, outdoor, ETX was necessary because binary losses were non-existent. But now when I experiment with my testbed with 11A, for instance, or even with ZigBee nodes, you know, losses kind of turn out to be between 0 and 1, and you see very few, almost no links with 0.5. So you can go back and see now, is ETX necessary or not? Similarly, MAC, opportunistic routing, experimental work on opportunistic routing, all of them assume the same transmit rate. That's because the hardness of an opportunistic routing protocol is trying to send to multiple receivers at the same time. So the transmit rate adaptation stuff is just hard to think about. Which particular receiver are you optimizing for? So that work has this limitation built in, that how do you think about transmit rate adaptation? A very simple change in setting, and you don't know whether or not opportunistic routing the experimental results is useful or not. Another example is rate adaptation, some of that I talked about. It's basically, when you do rate adaptation, commonly it's done in response to losses. But losses can happen due to either collisions or just poor SNR. And rate adaptation algorithms don't try and distinguish between that. And as a result, you know, any particular result you may have, how well a protocol works, you would not know, because if you move it to an environment where the loss patterns are different or you don't know what the extent of collisions is, you wouldn't know how well a rate adaptation algorithm works. Network topology itself, and this is kind of like one of my pet peeves these days, I see a lot of hidden terminal research happening. Like, they show hidden terminals, they have solutions to alleviate hidden terminals. But the experimental setup they have there is a mesh network. But the solution appears to be targeted in infrastructure networks, like, you know, AP kind of environments and whatnot. But clearly, you are likely to see more hidden terminals in a mesh scenario than an AP scenario where clients associate to APs. And that's kind of like a big limitation. Again, when I read this paper, I don't know. Is it going to work in infrastructure network or not? And that's, again, because of poorly specified topologies and what exactly is being targeted. Transport, enough said, enough people have noted, TCP, UDP performs completely differently, and thankfully there's enough appreciation of this thing in the community that now you never make the mistake of generalizing the UDP results to TCP unless people have actually done experiments with TCP. Application is another one, and it's a little subtle one, but depends if you looked at a lot of recent experimental work on network coding. They assume always on traffic. That's kind of like a really good case for network coding because you actually have packets to mix and do something. But real applications, if you measure them, data traffic that you see today, web browsing and whatnot, tends to be really bursty. I look at all the coding work again. I don't know. Does it work for real traffic? Who knows? Because the traffic bursty, you may not have any packet to code with other packets in that setting. Environment, again, big impact. A lot of our work is just driven by whatever interference environment you're given, by necessity or testbed. They may be interference-free or interference-ridden, depending on what experiment, what environment we are in. And we do a lot of work. Some very good work based on test words, and you clearly have no clue. And last is mobility. You know, if experiments have mobility, you can't just give up your hands and you get the results you can. I can't even begin to think how to actually capture mobility in any particular reasonable manner. So this is my last slide. Sort of like basically get some sense how the goal remains the same in the sense if I do my experimental work, how can I actually get some idea of how my result generalizes to other settings or not? And just throwing out three questions out there, exactly what should an experimental result capture about the environment? Clearly, more detail is better, but you know that has its limits. So I don't know what the guiding principle even should be. Should reproducibility, for instance, be the guiding principle, that I put enough detail in my paper, I document enough that others can reproduce my work? And another issue is, should practical approximations be okay? A very good practical approximation that may be okay is that, well, your underlying file layer, for instance, supports a gray loss model. But it turns out your topologies tends to be sparse, and the gray loss model in terms of distance of range is a very narrow one. It doesn't really appear, in which case, even though your losses can be gray, but in practice, they're always binary. So, you know, such approximations, you know, it's now different from, you know, that Newton's laws applies all the time unless you start thinking about domains that are actually in the fallen care of your database. And how exactly should we capture it in the work? One way to do that would be to, in our papers, we should have applicability considerations. When we write a paper with the experimental, how much do you think this result applies? And then, if somebody finds out it doesn't apply, then it's kind of like the onus of the author. Okay, you know, you claimed it applies, but, you know, but it does not. At the same time, you don't want authors to just go back, okay, our results applies to our specific setting and whatnot. There has to be some generalization for the result to be useful to the community at all. That's basically it. Thank you.
Questions, comments?
So I'd like to get back to this, I guess what you call gray level interference, which is a new term to me, but I'll go with it. And Elizabeth raised this earlier. So, and this comes back to a point that I tried to push this morning, which is, you know, what is a collision, right? And so certainly for those of us from the physical layer point of view, it's not really collision, no collision, it's how many users can you resolve. So even if you're trying to detect a single user, you might have a gray issue that you might want to treat there. Related to this is that it seems that when it comes to the physical layer, the way it is typically measured and used by higher layers is based on an average metric, versus an instantaneous metric. And the best way I can try to emphasize the point that I'm trying to make is Jensen's. Right? Am I trying to assess the probability of error based on being handed an average SNR, or am I trying to assess the average probability of error based on whatever my instantaneous SNR is? And what you're going to get in these two different situations are dramatically different. And so I think those of us who have a more physical layer perspective would say, see what you can do based on the instantaneous realization of the channel interference, et cetera, rather than focusing on designing algorithms based on average metrics. I think what you will see in practice, if you have some control over your physical layer, is going to be very different.
So just to clarify in the beginning, I at least wasn't advocating a particular rate adaptation behavior, whether it be instantaneous or average. I think the particular, I was mostly like generalizing from the behavior of typical transmit rate adaptation algorithms, which basically, you know, if a loss happens.
I owe
right.
this to everybody.
Right.
I'm not picking on you. I can pick on you for something
yeah.
else.
No, just to verify, yeah.
But again, you know, I think there are certainly those of us who definitely want to see a greater bridge or stronger bridge, a bigger bridge, whatever, between physical layer and networking. And I think this is one of the places where we have big challenges in terms of trying to have a common conversation. Another one is also just trying to have the right mathematical tools to make some of these bridges. So I've tried to collaborate with theoretical networking people, and sometimes it's hard because you have these very complicated expressions for what the physical layer can provide, and then when you try to use those, you know, it's not clear what the right abstraction is. And so I can totally see why these 0-1 models come up and why we look at things like average SNR. But I hope we can come up with a way to go beyond that so that we can get some new and interesting results. And I don't know the answer to that, but we seem to hit these two poles and complain about each other and hit the two poles and complain.
One of the issues is that we were lucky that in my case there is a natural separation of time scales, you know. And in the physical layer, you guys are happy dealing with sort of a smooth production of bits that come your way, and then you deal with the, you know, sort of channel variations. And it would have been nice if really that assumption was there, and it would have been really good from an networking perspective. But it's not clear to me which one is better. Do I want you guys to take care of channel variation in a way that translates into a much higher throughput but a longer delay, or do I want you to sacrifice some of your throughput?
So, you know, at least my opinion is tell me what the right thing is to optimize and I will work to optimize that.
But it's not separated. That's what I'm trying to say.
Mm-hmm.
Is that if you ask me what to optimize, and I ask you what to optimize, right? And then eventually we'll know.
Your comments remind me when I was the youngest professor, I went to Maryland, okay, the guys from mathematics told me, John, you know, you will tell us what you want to optimize almost. And then we'll do it. And I said, if I know what, I don't need you, I can do it.
No, but
this is 70% of the question, not
80%. Right, but you would think that we could be a little bit closer by now. And it's just going back to the statement that you made earlier, which is, you know, is throughput really what we should be optimizing when, at the end, there's an application riding on top of everything, and what the user wants may not necessarily be what we are.
Right, so I think if you really talk to companies, I even participated in workshops, at least on work basis, where the discussion centered around a very serious issue: what should we measure, and how do we measure it so it's standardized? So at least when he measures something and I measure something, then compare apples with apples, right? And although all the companies in the beginning agreed in the morning that we needed that, in the afternoon when we asked for real data, even anonymized, to try to do some analysis, the answer was zero, because it's confidential, we don't get, you know. So, as far as I'm concerned, if you really want to address the questions you're asking, we really have to go to measurements and metrics and understand what we need to do and then translate this to theory. I mean, if you follow so-called scientific approach, what do? You identify a phenomenon, then you measure it, you abstract, you go and ask whether it applies to new situations, you keep refining. We're not doing that.
Does that then mean we have to take an approach like Rice, which says that instead, you know, in a sense, be the company, have the base station? So, right? I mean, in a way, you get around all of this.
I think you have
your own tower. There is
you stopped. I had a general question for the panel, but perhaps you want to have the next person speak. I don't know what
you're no, just.
So you brought up what I think is probably the central question here is reproducibility, and I'll include not just, you know, hardware-based experimentation, but I'll say that simulation is sort of the gray area between theory and experiment and reproducibility of simulations. So I'd like the panel to comment. You asked a question, and I'd like the panel to comment on this central question of reproducibility of experiments, whether they be hardware or simulation based, when they get published in conferences and journals.
I think there's a main issue to that, always if you experiment on specific hardware, also you have a specific topology in a specific room. You can take your 10 nodes, put them in a different room, you have different furniture, and you'll get different results. But I think one step in the right direction is to have these publicly available test beds. You know, like the MODLAB at Harvard, there is one here, TWIST in Berlin, where everybody can just, on their code, they can run their experiments, you know, and there's exactly the same environment. And of course, the arrangement always changes a little bit, but overall, it is static enough so that the research community can go out and actually make fair comparisons and produce the results.
I've been generally very frightened of the results I've gotten from simulations, in that no two simulators give me the same results for any, even though I'm setting all the parameters the same, the output. There's this wonderful paper called Managed Simulations, The Incredibles, and it's sort of this litany of problems with simulation studies in our area. And I think the main issue is that interference models are just very poorly captured in today's simulators. And I don't know that it's a problem that cannot be fixed with some careful work, but it's just the state of the art in wireless simulations is just so bad that I wouldn't trust results coming out of pure simulations.
Even if you do it on the experimental platform, one example could be Buckley mode, and then there was a BMAP paper claiming 11 kilobits per second. When you actually have everything in the single room, single hub, and that's the best performance we can get, and we actually reproduce exactly the same environment at this end, we got 9 kilobits per second instead of 11 kilobits per second. So where's 2 kilobits per second go? We can't really match the number to number, because wireless, when they ask
Even in terms of trends, sometimes you get completely inverse results of throughput increasing with something where it's
right. So it's actually what we have to compare is the trend or the relative performance comparison with every other. So that makes the experiment work.
John,
really.
Do you have a comment?
So I just wanted to caution, it's easy to beat up simulators, and I think we need to take them with a big grain of salt, but to echo what John said, I'm not sure how many research results can be reproduced here. It's challenging to reproduce experimental.
But the issue with simulations is not just the reproducibility. I think it's fundamental trust in the fact that they're actually saying something meaningful. Somehow, even for the one instance that they're reporting, I guess, is what I'm getting at.
No, the thing is, you can use the same simulator again, and you will get the same result if you start with the same seed. But if you run an experiment, and we have seen that here, exactly the same topology.
Because that is the real world. There are going to be people moving around and change your link quality.
But it's completely unreproducible, that's the thing.
Right.
Because another experiment at the same time today, but not tomorrow. So it's completely different result. So what can I say?
So you can either reproduce fiction, or you can see reality once.
That's a good point.
I think the challenge is we need to be a lot more honest in doing things like putting, say, error bars in papers, to be clear about what the variation is, and not just say my average is X, and that is the answer.
I think this happened in congestion control research based on simulation. First of all, I think correctness with simulation is one thing, and we can doubt all we want, and different people draw different judgments. But there's really no excuse for simulation results to not be reproducible. I think we just have a low bar in terms of reproducibility and activity. People should put up their results and their code and whatnot. There's very rarely.
But remember, what happened with Wiblis in terms of Tintinotto, he said, no more papers are going to be published until you let us know exactly all the parameters of the algorithm, and unless we, the editors or somebody that we can assign to, can reproduce the results exactly like you can. This was in a much simpler situation. And that changed the algorithmic work, but here you cannot do it right, because, first, regarding simulation, you tell me what simulation program that you have or somebody has does any good job in describing the physical layer and all its vagaries, and I'll take my hat off, because some of the stuff we use, whether it's OpenNet, PubMed, or NS2, it's total fiction, right? To the point where some people call some of the results of NS2 simulations, these are NS2 results, I don't know where they apply, this is true. Okay. Now, the guy experimenter is us, right? Yeah. There are other people in other sciences that they have account of random phenomena. How do they handle them in terms of reproducibility? They use bars, they use other statistics, not just averages. They tell you how many experiments they have done. They are carefully varying the conditions so that they capture all of the statistics that they can, and they report it.
And there's a huge difference between a biology paper and a wireless networking paper.
But then if you look at biology again, they have gone to the extra step. They've gone to public databases where you can contribute, you can compare, you can assign. We don't have anything like that.
Sorry, we are a bit time constrained. I would like to give actually a chance to speak as well.
I'd like to come on that last question also. I mean, I'm very skeptical of simulation as well, but there's a major problem with experimental results, which is you're going to test on a single topology. Right, so if you want to test over scale or if you want to test over different densities and so on, you can't do that in the experimental world. So you do need to use simulations. I think we need to be a little bit lenient just in that sense. And one of the things we've been trying to do at least, and I think is probably a good practice, is to use trace-based simulations. So we're collecting traces, empirical traces, and running those through simulations and validating that. At least for one particular case, we get exactly the same results that we get in the empirical world. And now we can change the topology. And hopefully that simulator is at least validated enough that we can trust those results to some extent. So that's the approach we're trying to take. I guess with that, I'll start.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, go ahead.
Concerning traffic models, Poisson traffic, trace-driven traffic, and reproducibility, if I see a paper that says we applied some trace-driven traffic, how can I reproduce that? Or 20 years from now, I got to care that you use real-world network traffic. So what is your opinion? Because I know that a lot of experimental people, if they see a paper that says we use Poisson traffic, they say we're going to reject this paper. On the other hand, if I want to reproduce an experiment and the simulation has Poisson traffic, I'm very happy because I know how to simulate that. 20 years from now, I'm still going to know how to simulate Poisson traffic. So what is your opinion on this?
So the way we're taking trace data is actually kind of unusual. I wasn't going to go into detail, but since you asked, one of the things we're doing, for example, I know you mentioned simulations are hard. It's hard to simulate interference, and one of the things we're doing, for example, is measuring for each neighborhood all possible interference scenarios. So, you know, if these three nodes transmit, which nodes receive, these four nodes transmit, which nodes receive, and so on. Then we'll replay those using statistical models, using drawing the trace data given what's going on in the simulation. And so it's not exactly a trace-based scenario, it's not exactly a statistical model, it's kind of a hybrid between the two. And what we'll do is simulate the actual real topology to ensure that our statistical / trace-based model matches what we're seeing in the real world. And then we can change the topology and hope that still works. So that's really what we're doing. We're not using purely trace-based simulation. Question.
And are you really getting simulation results that match the real world? I would think even with input traces, it would be too hard to reproduce the radio and interference effects.
Well, we are getting exactly the same result. We're using t-tests to show that, you know, with some probability that's.
Yeah, it depends a little bit on what the environment is, though. If it's an environment where there's not a lot of external interference, not a lot of mobility in the environment, the nodes aren't moving, there is some amount of reproducibility you can get. So in sensor network test beds, at least remote test beds, that's often possible.
Yeah, but you don't get, where would you get a real world trace from a network like that?
Well, the real world here means your own test bed, right?
Yeah, so we deployed a test bed, collected some traces.
Which is kind of okay in the sensor network domain if it's going to be deployed in some industrial setting that's, you know, not going to change a lot over time.
It's still specific to, let's say, we deployed our network in our building. So, yeah, our simulation traces are only applicable to that kind of building scenario. If you deployed something else out in the field, in a grassy field, it wouldn't apply. But it's as good as we can get and still measure different topologies, different densities, and so on. Yeah.
But I think the short-term answer to Mike's question is that you make traces public. So for a lot of the internet measurement people, this is what they do. I collaborate with John Hyman on some denial of service attack work, and all the traces
but
we use are
20 years from now, is that link going to be available on the web, or is it going to be realistically available?
That's what I said. The short-term answer is what you do. And hopefully long-term we'll have a better way of addressing that. But then at least you have a set of data that anybody can use. It's common. And you can try different mechanisms that have some potential for apples-to-apples comparison.
I absolutely agree. All of our simulators are on the web. You know, at least a dozen different trace
So just as an example, suppose you have a traffic trace, one traffic trace. You have a network of two ports. Do you ever see the details that say, well, here's what we really did, but we've got two ports. Where did they apply the same traffic trace to both? Did they reverse the time of the traffic trace or randomize? You never see that detail. And so how are you going to know exactly how they implemented this trace base?
I'll let John speak to that. He has no idea what we're talking about.
Maybe I should move on.
Maybe we should.
We only have 11 minutes on this panel. So
this is a pretty exciting conversation, but yeah, maybe talk. So in this panel, at least, we talked about a number of different problems. In particular, a couple of double standards that you might see. So one is that only results on common radios matter. If you try to publish a paper that's not on an 8-to-11 radio, then someone's going to say, well, what kind of obscure radio is this, and why do these results matter? But at the same time, you can't publish results that are only on your 802.11 radio, because they're going to say, well, this is only specific to the 802.11 radio. And so we have this kind of double standard. And we also have this disconnect between hardware and radio protocols, or wireless protocols. But at the same time, when we build protocols that are hardware specific, again, the reviewer is going to say, well, why do I care about this protocol? Because it's hardware specific and only applies to this radio. So there's this double standard. And the interesting thing here is that this is not some double standard of that somebody else is imposing on us. We are the community, and this is our own double standard. And we say, we really need to bridge this gap, but at the same time, when we're reviewers, we'll say, this result is so specific to this hardware. So I think we need to ask ourselves the question, what constitutes a useful experimental result? And I think the right answer is all experimental results are useful. Right, and I think that's what we would all agree on eventually. We discussed it in detail. But again, we have to answer that question of, well, as a reviewer, do I accept this into a conference or not? And so I'd like to change the question a little bit to be more practical in the sense of a reviewer. And so the new question might be, what is the lifetime of an experimental result? In other words, how long is this experimental result going to be important? And maybe there are three ways that we can measure the lifetime, or three different kinds of classes. There are probably more classes, but I can talk about three. One is, well, we can use the experimental result to affect the parameters of our protocols, or to optimize our protocols to be more effective. And another one might be, well, we can use these experimental results to affect theoretical limits. And another one is, we can use these experimental results to affect future hardware design. And each of these have different lifetimes, right? So with the first one, if you're using your experimental results to optimize something, then as soon as the hardware changes, that result is now no longer valid, no longer meaningful. If you've affected the theoretical limits, that should always be meaningful as long as the hardware subscribes to the assumptions that you've made. And if you affect future hardware design, that kind of result is useful as long as your effect and a particular kind of thing you're adding to the design of a radio is being used. So with each of these, we'll have a different lifetime, and we can use this perhaps to start evaluating how important is a particular experimental result. So yes, they're all important. Now maybe we can come up with some sort of gradation which is the lifetime. And I'm going to go through a couple of examples. I know there are a lot more, but I'll just talk about a couple that might illustrate how we can apply the lifetime metric to an experimental result. So one kind of obvious one is, well, we can characterize the bit error probability of a particular kind of radio. And if we do that, we can optimize, let's say we can optimize the coding techniques, or we can optimize the packet lengths, or whatever it might be. And so we're going from the hardware up the OSIML to the PHY layer, and we're changing things at the PHY layer. But as soon as this radio changes, now that result is no longer valid. And so we can also do things, let's say, for a particular radio, we can characterize, let's say, the RxTS switch times, the time it takes to switch from receive mode or CCA mode to transmit mode. And that's going to affect things like how long your CSMA backoff is, or how long slots are that you want to use in CSMA. But again, as soon as you change radios, now that result no longer applies. So the optimization you made on CSMA no longer applies. Still, it's a very useful result. Now, there are other kinds of results that we might want to look at. So, for example, you might want to characterize the distribution of link quality. So, and given that, we might affect the network layer. So, we're moving up to the networking stack here.
And so we might say something like, well, the, I guess some recent results have said, I guess, what did you call it, the gray... gray fading model, gray connectivity model, or other also called the transition region, where some nodes are very highly connected, some nodes are connected with some probability between 0 and 1, or some nodes are not connected at all with almost, with almost any probability. And so this result was, this observation was made and used to affect the actual routing protocols used in wireless sensor networks. And once the radio upon which those characterizations were made changed, that entire routing protocol was no longer used anymore. But at the same time, there were results showing that, you know, in this transition region is fundamental. So actually, this is Busbar's result, so showing this transition region is fundamental for this particular class of radios. Even if you made the radios absolutely perfect, you would always have this transition. And so we actually, this particular routing protocol called MinRoute is no longer really being used anymore. But all future routing protocols need to account for this huge transition region where the connectivity is less than one or less than perfect for the majority of the radio range of that radio. And so this is something that's fundamental, and all routing protocols that deal with this class of radios need to deal with that. So those are two cases, one where we're optimizing performance and one where we're influencing theoretical bounds, both with experimental results. Another one that I'd like to talk about is how we might influence hardware design. And so here's a quick example of a quick little scheme that we can use given one particular radio. So in this scheme, we want to do collision detection using the capture effect. So in this case, you receive, let's imagine that A is a weak signal and B is a strong signal. The receiver is receiving the weak signal. As soon as it starts receiving the larger signal, the stronger signal, it can detect that there's a preamble byte coming in, and it detects a collision. So now it detected a collision using wireless analogs. If we continue moving on, we see the SFT, then we can resynchronize to that stronger transmitter, recover the stronger packet, and then we can actually recover a packet during the collision. And so we can continue receiving the rest of the stronger packet. So we've done the collision detection and also recovered a packet from collisions. We can also do it the other way around, where if the stronger packet arrives first, we synchronize to it, start receiving it. The weaker packet starts coming in, but of course, due to the capture effect, we don't even hear it. It doesn't cause any sort of corruption. We continue receiving the stronger packet. And then at the end, because we can receive the weaker packet, if we add a termination symbol there with another SFT, then we can detect that there was a weaker signal coming in at the same time. So now we can do collision detection both in stronger first and stronger last collision. So here's a little technique that we performed on one radio. And in fact, it doesn't work on most radios. Almost no other radios can you do this. And the reason is because once you synchronize to a packet, there's no way to resynchronize to another packet coming in. Right, so we did this with a radio that had a byte level interface. When you've got a packet level interface, which is the case most of the time, there's no way to really resynchronize. But this effect, the ability to do this could have long-lasting implications. So, for example, if we can detect collisions, we can send NACs wirelessly. If we can send NACs, maybe we can have reliable broadcasts. So that's also pretty valuable. if we have TDMA and we're losing packets, in this case, we don't know if it's because there's another node that has the same slot, let's say, with a different receiver, or if it's because I have a bad link to my parent. But if we have collision detection, we can actually differentiate between those two. So we can differentiate between the two actions of changing slots or changing parents. So this can have an effect on TDMA. Also with CSMA, if we know which nodes we're going to overpower using capture, then we can decide whether or not to transmit simultaneously with a neighbor. And we can figure out whether we'll capture the channel because we have this thing, this mechanism that will tell us, yes, in the past you have overpowered southern node during a collision. And the same thing with RTS-CTS and a number of other things. So we can actually do, hopefully, CSMA-CD, where instead of delaying all our transmissions and being very conservative on collision avoidance, instead we want to be very aggressive. We want to just transmit as soon as we can, detect the collision, and recover from that. And hopefully that will reduce, we'll have some channel wastage due to collisions, but hopefully we'll have less channel wastage due to overhead like delays and control packets and so on. So So there could be a lot of effects based on this. And what we would hope is that we can take that result that we got with one radio that says, if you can resynchronize to a new incoming packet, you can do collision detection, and push that back down the stack and say, we want new radios to be able to do this. And we've actually done that. We talked to ChipCon. I guess our results weren't strong enough for them to change their new radio because they did it. But we did talk to them, and hopefully demonstrating more results here, we might be able to get different radio manufacturers to change the way they build radios. And so given, my slides are a little bit out of order, but given that this mechanism isn't 100% effective, right? There are probabilities involved here. Sometimes the packets will be very close to each other, and their premiums might overlap. It's very hard to detect an SFT, the second SFT, and so on. So we're going to get some probability of success here. And that's going to depend on the number of different factors, including, for example, the co-channel interference tolerance of a particular radio, for example, the header field of a particular packet or in your file layer, for example, your encoding scheme, and so on. So there are a lot of things that will affect how this works, and we'll have to do empirical measurements to show, basically, how to characterize how well this works, and therefore to apply those characterizations to higher level protocols. And hopefully, that kind of this kind of result is something that would affect hardware design. And so one question then is, well, is it even possible to affect hardware design? Is that really important? Is that really something we should be striving for? You know, 802.11 radios have already been deployed on almost every single laptop in the world and a lot of other devices as well. Does it make sense for us to try and change hardware design? And I think we can look at this observation here, which is that since 1997, we've had about a new generation of 802.11s about every 2 years. And so because of that, it does make sense to try and change hardware design, right? Because even if we do have 802.11 radios on our laptops, in a couple of years, there will be another generation. Laptops, again, only last, our laptops only last a couple of years, 2 or 3 years. So people are buying new laptops all the time, new PDAs all the time, whatever else it might be. Cell phones might have a six-month lifetime nowadays. So I think it does make sense to try and change. I think even if you're not optimizing your protocols, and even if you're not influencing theoretical results, if you are showing new capabilities with a particular radio hardware, radio architecture, that result could still be meaningful, could still have a long lifetime if that architecture influences the design of future radios. And I think that's pretty much all I have to say.
Okay, I have a follow-up question, right, regarding this hardware and all that stuff. If we agree, and I hope we agree, that given that you can buy or be near a lab which has FPGAs, and the system that allows you to take any algorithm, map it to FPGA for real-time implementation, and assuming also that you have in the lab capabilities to design antennas of any kind of performance, right? Why can't, if I put these two together for the purpose of research, reduce the whole question of hardware versus software is just software? Because in other words, I do this as a software design, and if I am happy with the performance of this bulky, expensive radios, right, that I get, then I can go hire somebody who's going to do the miniaturization for me. Isn't that what most companies are doing today when they want to implement something in hardware? So this says to me that the problem is really more of a software design problem, and then once you understand what to do in software, it becomes a platform-based design in the sense that I know by the program specification, what's the definition of my program, and all I have to ask now is, can I implement this particular hardware platform, which is a problem that people have addressed and can be solved given constraints on expenses and all that stuff. Right? So why?
I think it's missing expertise.
Why are you making such a big issue on the hardware?
But I think it's a missing expertise. I think we just don't have people in this community that understand how to do hardware specifications and do even FPGA design. It's as simple as that.
I think we can do hardware design and software design at the same time. I'm sure that's how companies do it. You're right, we don't have expertise, but at the same time, there's also this double standard where people who are doing papers on 802.11 radios might say this is...
Oh, well, I have a very easy, although ugly answer for that, okay? You're going to have to make a decision in your life when you do some work, whether this is going to be for the publisher or for the lab, as you say, okay? Because
you will find, if you ask poor people like me, that if you decide to do something for the lab, you're going to have a hard time publishing no matter what field you are. And if you do something on Ethereum, you will have a much easier time to publish it. Because very simply put, okay, as you all said, it's much easier to do theory in terms of resources than in terms of your brain. Because, you know, it's like a poor man's, you know, way of doing real systems, right? Versus doing real hardware design, because it's expensive.
Okay.
And very few places, even in industry, have the appropriate apparatus and expertise to actually do what I'm describing. So I won't argue about the yields. Okay. Some of the reviewers, I mean, with due respect, they ask to self-evaluate themselves, and they cannot even do that. Okay, but they will write a review. Okay, so
I think it's a constant economy to decide whether you're doing something for the
better
world.
I agree. I mean, if you want to do a real experimental work, okay, find somebody who's a good experimenter. There are few around.
You apply the
work
same,
with them.
You apply the same criteria to your own work that you do to other people's work, right? So
I do, but I mean, you know, whenever we did real work with companies that I work with, and I can give you stories upon stories. Okay, for almost 15 years. Okay, almost 2 or 3% of this work got published as a paper. Because we ran into the problem you just described, and we said, okay, we'll go for patents, we'll go for the commercial products, we'll get our publicity that way, we'll get newspaper articles, that's on the publication. And many universities actually start becoming real with this balance between real good experimental work and papers. It's not all papers. I'd like to encourage the young people, especially, not to think just it's all papers.
Like I said, I think it's a false economy. If I were to write a paper that I thought would be important, it's because it is important, right? So,
but write a nice report.
The question is, what's that?
Write a nice report that the biologists will do to your experiments. Write a nice report. Trust me, there was the upper bound papers of the old times on adaptive array antennas. Right? This paper was a huge report. Okay, a huge aircraft report. It was so good and so good experimentally that people who referred to it in the end. They went and found some sort of a Xerox of the report, and somebody typed it and published it almost 35 years after he did the work. So what I'm saying is that good experimental work, it would find its way to fame publicity, and not just papers.
Sorry, maybe I'm running out of time. I just want to take 30 seconds to say a few words about a very different experimental setup. Maybe just taking two radio devices and measure signal strengths and try and learn something for it. So I have found that loop useful, though. Just take a big turntable and let it spin, measure signal strengths, you know, and see what happens. You see on the right what's going on, no? So we see about 25 dB variation in received signal strengths, not just over rotation of this turntable, and we see a perfectly periodic pattern, no? So there's no randomness in small-scale fading, but what we receive is simply a function of where a particular mode, in this case, was placed in the room, rotating on the turntable. The other thing we can learn, for example, is that spread spectrum doesn't help because we have exactly the same pattern when we use Zigbee radio, no? So a lot of people claim that this helps with small-scale fading, but it doesn't, no? So the message is just, I think there's a lot to learn from very simple things. We don't need 100 nodes, we don't need necessarily software radios, but encouraging people to do simple things and just carefully interpret them and learn about the physical layer. And then with this, we can play experiments where we can actually put the mode in the best place. We can have the turntable spin and stop when it's in the optimum position with respect to fading, or we can put it in a bad spot and see how the protocols react. So there are a lot of games we can play with very simple things without sophisticated hardware.
But Martin, how far apart are these two?
Oh, they are not talking to each other. I mean, there is someone on the turntable and the other guy is 4 meters away on a desk. So there's a line of sight pass, you know, well, but you look at the amplitude, it's pretty close to radio fading. It's kind of nice. There's a little bit of what you see, you know, in the direct pass. But you can use that to learn about the statistics, you know, the fading pattern. Also about coherence time, you know, they will be surprisingly large, you know, if you don't have mobility. Then these links are not going to change over a few seconds. Also, retransmissions don't help and things. So we can learn a lot. Yeah. Okay, I think with that we have to conclude. Yeah, thanks to all the panelists.